The cowbell, hanging from the sack on a rope that served John the lawyer as a door, clanged once. He looked up and saw one of the most beautiful women he'd ever encountered. A bit of context. John had led a sheltered early life in a remote village, from which he'd run away very shortly after he'd learned to run. Thereafter, he'd lived among elves. Out of the 13 women he had met, however, not including his mother, she was definitely number 4, and quite possibly number 3. That made her pretty hot stuff. "Hello," she said. "Remember me?" "No?" She scowled at him. "Is that right?" He blinked. "Sorry," he said, "but I'm fairly sure I've never seen you before."
"You haven't."
John's mouth fell open. He was hopeless with names and not much better with faces, but he never forgot snarky syntax.
"You're her," he said.
"Not anymore." She beamed at him. "I quit."
"You quit?"
"All right, I was fired. Sort of. Actually, it was all very friendly. King Mordak and I agreed on a parting of the ways. He's such a nice person once you get to know him."
John's brain was racing. "You want me to sue King Mordak for unfair dismissal?"
"Don't be silly." "Anyhow, it wasn't unfair dismissal. It was eminently reasonable dismissal with overtones of mutual respect and understanding."
"Ah, I don't think you'd get much in the way of damages for that."
"I don't want to hire you," she said irritably. "I just saw your board up with the atrocious spelling and thought I'd pop in and say hello."
John stared.
"You did?"
"Yes."
"But you're a..." He cut the G word off just in time. "You're very welcome," he said. "Would you like a cup of tea?"
She pursed her lips.
"Food and drink," she said. "Gosh, I'd forgotten all about those. And all the other stuff, too."
He gave her a blank look.
"Going to the lavatory," she spelled out. "I'm hoping it'll all come back to me, but it's been ever so long."
"Wraiths don't..."
"No, it's going to be very strange for a bit," she went on, as John glowed bright red like a sunset. "Getting used to being human again, I mean. I don't suppose there's ever been an ex-wraith before. It'll be quite a challenge."
John looked up.
"I could sue Mordak for mental distress and trauma, if you like." "Watch my lips."
A superfluous order, if ever there was one.
"I don't want you suing anybody for anything on my account. For one thing, I haven't got any money to pay you."
"That's all right. I'd do it for free."
It all came out in a rush, like a dozen puppies who'd been shut up indoors all day. "I mean, on a sort of contingency, pro bono basis," he backpedaled furiously. But she was grinning at him. "That's so sweet," she didn't need to say. "But not if you don't want to. I mean, I wasn't touting for business or anything like that."
"I didn't think you were.
How is business, by the way?"
"Booming," John swallowed.
"Absolutely booming." She put her head on one side and peered at him. "You don't sound all that happy about that. Which is very odd indeed, considering."
John hesitated.
He'd never had anyone to confide in since he was very young, and even back then his only friend had been invisible to everybody else. No change there, then. He considered that, and decided that things were looking up. "I'm not," he said. "Hmm?" She gave him a sympathetic look. "Won't pay up?" "On the contrary." He pointed to the corner of the shed, where three bulging sacks of gold filled a large manger. "That's just on account," he said. "Expense no object," he said. She nodded. "No wonder you're worried." "It's what he wants me to do," John burst out, and even he was surprised at the level of panic in his voice. "He wants the realms? Freehold. Vacant possession." She looked at him oddly for about a count of 10. Then she said, "Is that right?" John sighed. "I've served notice to quit on Mordak," he said. "And next I've got to do King Drain and the elves." He shook his head. "They're not going to like it." She sat down beside him. "There's an old human expression," she said. "Actually, there's three. One's about birds in hands. One says that possession is 9/10 of the law. And the third is, you and whose army?" "He's barking. Got to be."
"That's what I keep telling myself."
"And?"
By way of reply, John pointed at the door.
"John the liar," he said.
"Look, this is no harmless eccentric. You've only got to talk to him to know that. He's scary." From the fact that John had served a writ on the Dark Lord and tried to chat up a wraith, she'd already deduced that he didn't scare easily.
"I see." "And he's got lots and lots of money," John went on.
"I had an alchemist test those coins. Pure gold, pure! A substance," he added, "which is never found in nature, and which can only be created artificially by really advanced alchemy. Or, well, the other thing." She looked blank. He lowered his voice and looked around.
"You know," he hissed, "the M word. I think he's got to be some sort of dark wizard. Got to be."
She considered patting him on the back, but decided a frostbitten shoulder probably wouldn't help. Then she remembered. Human again. For some reason, that made her feel absurdly cheerful.
"Well, I can set your mind at rest there," she said. "Unless he's been hired in the last hour, he's not one of our lot, because I'd have heard about it if he was. Therefore, he's not a servant of the Dark Lord. Therefore, he's not an officially authorized agent of evil. So that's all right."
"I know that," John said. Sorry, no offence," he added reassuringly quickly.
"But he got me to serve a writ on Mordak. So obviously, he's not evil."
"So like I said, doesn't mean to say he isn't very, very bad. In fact," John lowered his voice until it was barely audible,
"I think he's worse."
"Worse than evil?"
"Worse than new evil, anyhow."
That gave her pause for thought. New evil had just conspired against and outwitted itself to save the life of a strategically valueless she-goblin.
and had gone to great lengths to let the natural scapegoat off the hook.
"Describe him," she said briskly.
Difficult, John admitted. "He's all muffled up, so I couldn't tell you what he looks like."
She frowned.
"That doesn't necessarily make him a bad person." "No, no, absolutely not. And he is very polite and nice. Says thank you and how well I'm doing. And incredibly generous."
"Which makes you like him and disposes you to do what he asks you to?"
"Yes."
She'd been living at just below the temperature of liquid helium for so long that she'd forgotten what it felt like to be cold. But a genuine shiver ran down her spine, and she didn't like it one bit. An evil mastermind who understands man management, she said. That's a dangerous precedent.
John wasn't looking at her. She took that as a bad sign.
"It's the self-confidence that bothers me as well," he said. "He doesn't seem bothered about the practicalities of, well, evicting people. And dwarves and goblins. Sort of gives the impression that that wouldn't be a problem, so long as I get him the legal title. Makes me wonder whether he's got more up his sleeve than just an arm."
She tried to sound dismissive. She made a bit of a hash of it.
"Really? Such as what?"
"Ah, I don't know, magic, a secret weapon. But that's silly," he added. "That's only in stories, surely."
She was quiet for a moment. Then she said, "Keep this to yourself. But the other day, Mordak went out with the entire goblin army and came back a few hours later, and they were all a bit quiet and subdued. And all there."
John frowned.
"Implying that they went somewhere to fight someone and decided not to."
"To give you a bit of context," she said, "according to the manual, provided the objective is achieved, acceptable losses for goblin generals are set at 99%. But they didn't fight. Thought it probably wouldn't be a good idea. Now, don't you find that just a little bit disturbing?"
John put his hands to his head.
"This is all a bit far-fetched, isn't it? Secret weapons and an evil overlord who's more evil than the evil overlord. There's got to be a simpler explanation than that."
"Really? So what about the prophecy?"
"What prophecy?" "Who could it possibly be?" Barry Lushington wondered. "At this time of night."
He struggled into his dressing gown and lumbered blearily up the stairs to the front door. As strongly advised by the agent, he drew back the little sliding panel in the door and peered through it before drawing back the bolts.
Nobody to be seen.
Muttering something about bloody kids, he turned away. As he did so, three powerful blows made the door shiver in its frame.
"All right," he yelled, shooting all six bolts and unlatching the massive chain. "And don't make such a bloody awful row. You'll wake her up and then..."
He stopped. Nobody there.
"Lushington."
It was a deep voice, and grim.
"Hello?" Barry said. "Look, stop playing silly buggers. Who is it?"
A dark shape materialized in the doorway, visible only as a darker black against the sky.
I have come.
You what?
You sent for me. Many weary miles have I travelled, by dark and perilous roads. Stand back.
Barry glanced up at the silhouetted head, then down. He caught sight of a big canvas bag hanging from a shrouded arm. The handle of a screwdriver poked out from under the flap. The penny dropped.
Oh, he said, you're the plot.
Lightning fast, a hand shot out and covered his mouth.
Not so loud,
the voice hissed, and Barry found himself being nudged backwards. The stranger shut the door and shot the bolts, then drew back his hood to reveal a gaunt, weather-beaten face with startlingly bright blue eyes.
The plumber, he said with a crooked smile. Yes, many have called me that, and many other things beside. I am Araldor, son of Araldite, and I have come at the turning of the tide.
He dropped his bag on Barry's foot and looked round, his bright eyes piercing the shadows.
What seems to be the problem?
Barry shifted his foot and flexed his toes.
Isn't it a bit late to be making calls?
Araldor threw his cloak over his shoulder, revealing a dark green boiler suit and a tool belt studded with pale white gemstones.
It is later than you think, he said grimly. I heard rumours, far away in the north, about an untimely knocking.
Barry nodded.
The pipes, he said. It's driving Pat spare. She can't get to sleep because of it.
She would do well not to sleep too soundly.
Araldor replied softly.
Show me the way.
It took nearly half an hour to get from the front door to the area they'd somewhat arbitrarily christened the cellar. After all, Pat had pointed out, the whole place is a bloody cellar, isn't it?
Where the seething tangle of pipework seemed to be most heavily concentrated.
First, there's a sort of banging, Barry explained. Then this god-awful clanking, and then it stops for a bit. And then there's this ghastly sort of booming noise, followed by loads and loads of little taps and gurgles. Pat reckons it must be an air pocket somewhere.
Araldor shook his head.
There are worse things than air pockets in the dark places of the earth, he said darkly.
Then he stopped dead in his tracks, dropped to his knees, and pressed his ear to the flagstones. He stayed there, completely motionless, for about 30 seconds, then stood up abruptly and threw back his cloak. He seemed to enjoy doing that, to reveal the haft of an adjustable wrench protruding from his tool belt. He seemed to notice that Barry was staring at him and drew the spanner. The haft was intact, but it was broken off about an inch short of where the head should have been.
The wrench that was broken, he said. Not much use, I dare say. But the day will come when it shall be reforged anew. Where's the stopcock?
No idea, Barry confessed. Excuse me asking this, but you're, human, aren't you?
That got him a cold stare.
30 generations ago, my forefathers came out of the West on 7 white ships, if that's what you mean.
He turned away following one particular pipe with the tips of his long, lean fingers. He closed his eyes and muttered something under his breath in a strange language, edging along a foot at a time as he did so. Then he opened his eyes and lunged to the floor.
"Behold," he said, "the stopcock of Mored Zaram."
He pushed aside the remains of an old wooden crate to reveal a small, rusty handwheel. "Only," Barry persevered, "you're the first, human we've met since we've been here, and I was wondering, are there many more of us? I mean, you? I mean, humans?" A look of infinite sadness filled Adeldor's eyes.
"The race of the children of men grows weak," he said. "Few now remain of the line of those who once crossed the western seas before the realms were sundered. Yet hope remains while hearts are true. Looks like your whole system needs draining."
"Oh," Barry said, "that doesn't sound very good."
"Fear not."
Adeldor's hand slammed between Barry's shoulder blades, and for a moment his vision blurred.
"The day will come when all these pipes shall burst, and the joints that were soldered shall fail, and every sink shall be blocked, and every toilet shall back up, and the flood waters shall rise until all the caverns of Kizar Zalad are overwhelmed, and the chasm of Kazem shall be as a running river. But today is not that day. The day shall come when the seas shall arise, and the rivers overflow their banks, and a gull might fly all day from the peak of Mount Orodros and never find a place to perch dryfoot. But today is not that day. Not while gaskets still hold, and brave hand may yet grasp pipe wrench. The day will come—" "Oh, snot."
In his enthusiasm, he'd kicked his tool bag down one of the open manholes. They stood and listened as it fell. Clank, 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 against the sides of the shaft. Then, an impossibly long time later, they heard a distant splash. Barry looked at him. "That's a long way down, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"You're going to have to drain all that?" Adeldor didn't seem to be listening to him. A rapt look covered his motionless face. Then, from far below, came an ominous thump. Barry was nodding. "That's how it usually starts," he said. "You just listen. Shh." More banging. Then that eerie shrieking noise that always set Pat's teeth on edge. Then a repeating tattoo of dull thuds. "The pipes will start quivering in a minute," Barry said, only to get Alder's hand over his mouth again. Sure enough, they heard a succession of loud bangs, and the pipework began to shake. Adeldor let go of him and stood up. His eyes were open very wide.
"What day is it today?"
he asked. "What? Oh, right, Thursday."
"Thursday."
Adeldor was halfway to the stairs.
"Very sorry. Got my days mixed up. I'm due at another job a long, long away, away. I'll drop by later this week, maybe early next. I can see myself out. Good luck."
There was a clatter of heavy boots on the stairs, and Barry was alone. "Ah, well," he thought. "Plumbers, eh?" The banging was getting louder, worse than he'd ever heard it before. He winced. There was no way Pat was going to be able to sleep through that lot, and if she didn't get her 8 hours, he was in for a long, weary day. He gazed mournfully at the manhole the plumber had accidentally kicked his tool bag down, and noticed that it was glowing with a faint orange light. Funny, he thought, because the fall of the tool bag had proved how deep the hole was, so even if there'd been a torch in the bag and it had somehow got switched on, surely the beam wouldn't reach that far up. Also, was it his imagination, or was it getting a bit warm? A horrible thought crossed his mind. Mine shafts. Canaries, natural gas deposits. If the fool had contrived to start a fire down there... He panicked for a moment, until a mental image of himself sitting at the laptop, paying the insurance premium, filled his mental screen. They were covered. So that was all right. Even so... He looked round for a bucket or something. Pretty pointless, as the water all came from that stupid pond-cum-reservoir 8 levels up, and there was no way he was going to spend the rest of the night trotting up and down all those stairs. He'd give himself a coronary. He sat down on the fattest of the pipes and wiped his forehead. The banging was so loud he couldn't hear himself think. And why does everything have to happen in the middle of the night? Barry, it started again. Pat was standing in the doorway, huddled in a pink toweling robe. I'd gathered that. Bloody plumber. He was just here, Barry told her. He kicked a bag of tools down the hole. I think that's what's made it so bad. Before she could contradict him, a tongue of flame shot up through the hole, roaring like a waterfall. The flames licked the roof 12 feet up. Oh, marvellous, Pat said. Well, don't just sit there. Call the fire brigade. I don't think there is one. She opened her mouth, then closed it again. I must have been mad, she said. I should never have let you talk me into coming here. Me? Talk you? She wasn't listening. Her mouth was wide open. Her eyes were popping out of her head, and she was staring at the fiery red hand that was clawing for a handhold at the rim of the manhole. It was the size of an opened umbrella, and the fingers ended in jets of orange flame. Barry, she whispered, do something. At another time, in a wildly different context, he'd have been touched by her faith in him. As it was, he could do nothing except watch as the fingers sank into the solid granite flagstone as if into butter. The stone bubbled and pooled where the fingertips dug in. Somewhere, under their feet, not nearly far enough away, something bellowed. The floor shook, and dust fell from the roof. They could barely hear the banging and thumping now. The dominant noise was a terrifying creaking, suggesting strong materials under intolerable stress. Barry waved at Pat to back away slowly towards the doorway, but she stayed where she was, rooted to the spot, and he found he was too. Cracks appeared in the floor, running like spilt liquid. When they were an inch wide, there was a deafening crunch, and all around the manhole the flagstones abruptly gave way, as a monstrous head and shoulders burst through in a cloud of grit and shattered masonry. The head had eyes,
did it ever have eyes, and two dots for a nose, but the rest of it was shimmering red flame. Pat was transfixed by the sight.
"So that's what the brochure meant by underfloor heating," she said.
The monster hauled itself up through the broken floor. It had to crouch to stand upright in the high vaulted chamber. Its body was all fire, and from its back sprouted great burning wings that stretched from wall to wall, and when it spoke, it was like the blast of an erupting volcano. "Look here," it said. "Would you mind awfully keeping the noise down?"